when we wake up in the mansion world, this red button of decision will register directly in the soul. I think the human soul is conscious. The superconscious mind is the north temperate zone. But the north polar regions are the regions of what I would denominate the mid mind. It is the mind between the divine mind and the purely human mind. And this is not material mind. This is a Marantia reality, a Marantia embryo. The process of gestation is going on. I am aborning me to be. I think this soul can register things if it's beyond the purely fetal stage, the early fetal stage. I think I can find you a citation that will support that.
We feel like it.
I think they can run a gallop pull on these souls. Let me see, this is in Seraphic Hosts. Here's an interesting statement. Over on page 432, third paragraph on Supervisor Seraphim. We're up on the constellation level now, where the legislative function. They're talking about the law forecasters. In other words, these are the experts which they consult when they say we're contemplating the passing of such and such a law, and how it work out. You see, if we had experts like that, we would never pass the Prohibition Amendment. The law forecasters would say, you are going to turn a gradually temperate group into a drinking group. Near the end of the paragraph, these seraphim seek no special favors for one group or another. They're not lobbyists. But they do appear before the celestial lawmakers to speak for those who cannot be present, to speak for themselves. Even mortal man may contribute to the evolution of universe law. For these very seraphim do faithfully and fully portray not necessarily man's transient and conscious desires, but rather the true longings of the inner man, the evolving Marantia soul of the material mortal on the worlds of space. These seraphim run a gallop poll. And what do they deal with? They deal with human beings at the level of the evolving soul. We never knew we were polled. This all happened in the North Polar regions. You follow me? And this tells me something about a soul down here. This soul is not unconscious. Even though I am not conscious of the consciousness of my embryonic soul, this soul can speak. And this soul can speak for me, because my material mind is the mother of this soul, as the adjuster is the father of this soul. This is our child. That intrigues the dickens out of me. And then again, while we're on the soul, we'll get back to personality sooner or later. Let's turn over to page 1257. Discusses the Reserve Corps of Destiny. Are y'all familiar with that section? There's about 1,000 human beings on Earth who collaborate with the seraphim, who are practically speaking the superhuman government of this planet. We've talked about two groups of seraphim, the Progress Angels and the Religious Guardians, as a good example of the Promethean-Epimethean balancing. These 1,000 mortals, approximately 1,000, are trained and rehearsed to act in certain planetary emergencies. If you think of a famous human being, he probably is not a reservist, because by far the majority live and die and never function. The emergency didn't take place. It's like an insurance policy. It's like an accident policy. You have it, but you hope you don't cash in on it. These folks, I gather from this section here, function group-wise. Over on the next page, it says, in paragraph 3, the Corps has no permanent head, but does have permanent councils which constitute its governing organization. These embrace the Judiciary Council, the Historicity Council, the Council on Political Sovereignty, and many others. From time to time, in accordance with the Corps organization, titular mortal heads of the whole Reserve Corps have been commissioned by these permanent councils for specific function. The tenure of such reservist chiefs is usually a matter of a few hours' duration, being limited to the accomplishment of some specific task at hand. Now, what's functioning here? I think the soul is functioning. And I think the soul could function if you stopped all other function. And if you stopped all other function, the reservist would have to be asleep, wouldn't he? Couldn't be any conscious interference. Maybe even the thought adjuster wouldn't be there. And then maybe these human beings could collaborate, unknowingly collaborate as a group at the Marantia level of the soul. I've often pondered, suppose a reservist were engaged in actual warfare. Would they put him to sleep and let him get shot up? No. I'm sure they wouldn't do that. I'm sure they'd never jeopardize a human being. But suppose a battle were in progress. What could they do? Well, I can think of one thing, and I always think they do the simplest thing possible. They could make fog. They could get that darn thing so foggy that there could be no fighting if it were that important. As long as we're discussing the soul, I think this paragraph is very interesting. I think in certain instances, a soul is functional here on Earth, but only under peculiar circumstances. What's Reserve Corps? Fascinating section, anyway.
Bill, before you leave that, on page 12, page 7, speaks, all reserves have subconscious adjustment.
Yes.
How do you distinguish between the subconscious and the ordinary adjuster?
The subconscious adjuster is not a virgin adjuster. It's, well, let's go over and read what they say about self-conscious adjusters. It's on page 1196. There's a section entitled Self-Acting Adjusters. And it's item 4. It goes on to say that these adjusters seem to possess a marked degree of will in all matters not involving the human personalities of their immediate indwelling, as is indicated by their numerous exploits, both within and without the mortal subjects of attachment. Such adjusters participate in numerous activities of the realm, but more frequently they function as undetected indwellers of the earthly tabernacles of their own choosing. Undoubtedly, these higher and more experienced types of adjusters can communicate with those in other realms. But while self-acting adjusters do thus intercommunicate, they do so only on the levels of their mutual work and for the purpose of preserving custodial data essential to the adjuster ministry of the realms of their sojourn, though on occasions they have been known to function in interplanetary matters during times of crisis. This is a real emergency line of communication, which would work in the absence of all other lines of communication.
In the next paragraph, Bill, it says that they can leave the human body at will.
Yes.
What particular relationship would the soul and the personality take up if your adjuster left for any length of time? Like,
I would guess if it were by design, you'd be asleep. I don't think you would be functional to all practical intents and purposes during that time. I'm guessing here now, but that would seem reasonable.
Well, it says again here, in the original life plans they were provided for, but they are not indispensable to material existence.
That's right. Because not all mortals have them prior to the coming of the Spirit of Truth. Cain didn't have an adjuster until he asked for one.
Personally known anyone who you think might not have had an adjuster?
I'd say any idiot, and I'm using the term literally. Mm-hmm. I don't think idiots have them. I don't think they're human. I don't think the top two adjutants are there. I don't think they're personal either. I think let's think of a human being who was injured in such a way as to destroy normal thought process from there on. I think at that point, the adjuster leaves. And at that point, in the universe records, the affairs of this human being are wound up. He's dead, as far as the universe is concerned. His body might live on like a vegetable for quite a number of years. But in the records of the universe, he died the day of the accident.
It's just because the same as where a person becomes really insane.
Yes. Total insanity, I think, would liberate the adjuster.
Total insanity. Now, suppose you find someone who is occasionally insane, as a sex pervert.
Well, I think the adjuster would stand by if the individual has rational interludes and would try to help that person. Let's say you were out for a long time, but could come back, I think the adjuster would stay right here, patiently awaiting the return of normal consciousness.
Patient.
Sure. Well, I use the word because I'm patient, but the adjuster is beyond that. I'm often impatient, too.
Something I would like to discuss sometime, Bill, when we get around to it, is the spiritual. We mentioned that, Dorothy, spiritual life, like physical energy, is consumed. Spiritual effort results in relative spiritual exhaustion.
What page?
I ask you, how is the spirit replenished? How is spiritual energy restored?
Well, let's read what Rodin said about that.
Did we ever answer that? We did somewhat, didn't we?
You know, the only thing I could never find was, I was looking in my 4-volume edition for Rodin and I couldn't find it. And finally I looked it up in the index, and you know the joker that bound my edition has left a whole folio out of my part 4.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, it's in this paper somewhere, but I'll have to find it.
Yeah.
Yes, here it is. Page 1774, paragraph 3. 3 and 4 and 5. The greatest of all methods of problem solving I've learned from Jesus, your master. I refer to that which he so consistently practices and which he has so faithfully taught you, the isolation of worshipful meditation. In this habit of Jesus going off so frequently by himself to commune with the Father in heaven is to be found the technique not only of gathering strength and wisdom for the ordinary conflicts of living, but also of appropriating the energy for the solution of the higher problems of a moral and spiritual nature. But even correct methods of solving problems will not compensate for inherent defects of personality or atone for the absence of the hunger and thirst for true righteousness. I'm deeply impressed with the custom of Jesus in going apart by himself to engage in these seasons of solitary survey of the problems of living, to seek for new stores of wisdom and energy for meeting the manifold demands of social service, to quicken and deepen the supreme purpose of living by actually subjecting the total personality to the consciousness of contacting with divinity, to grasp for possession of new and better methods of adjusting oneself to the ever-changing situations of living existence, to effect those vital reconstructions and readjustments of one's personal attitudes which are so essential to enhanced insight into everything worthwhile and real, and to do all this with an eye single to the glory of God, to breathe in sincerity your master's favorite prayer, "Not my will, but yours be done." This worshipful practice of your master brings that relaxation which renews the mind, that illumination which inspires the soul, that courage which enables one bravely to face one's problems, that self-understanding which obliterates debilitating fear, and that consciousness of union with divinity which equips man with the self-assurance that enables him to dare to be godlike. The relaxation of worship or spiritual communion as practiced by the master relieves tension, removes conflicts, and mightily augments the total resources of the personality. And all this philosophy plus the gospel of the kingdom constitutes the new religion, as I understand it. That was quite a Greek, wasn't he?
Wasn't he a marvelous one? Mm-hmm.
This is a place where Jesus called the apostles together.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Jesus' apostles are trying to get together. They got so excited for the contention. Mm-hmm. Jesus called a three-day halt. It went off for a rest, a three-day exhilaration picnic. And they were glad that they told them not to talk about their troubles. They came back for this recreation.
I think there's another awfully good quote on page 1001. Prayer may become an established custom. Many pray because others do. Still others pray because they fear something direful may happen if they do not offer their regular supplications. To some individuals, prayer is the calm expression of gratitude. To others, a group expression of praise, social devotions. Sometimes it is the imitation of another's religion, while in true praying, it is the sincere and trusting communication of the spiritual nature of the creature with the anywhere presence of the spirit of the Creator. Prayer may be a spontaneous expression of God consciousness or a meaningless recitation of theologic formulas. It may be the ecstatic praise of a God-knowing soul or the slavish obeisance of a fear-ridden mortal. It is sometimes the pathetic expression of spiritual craving, and sometimes the blatant shouting of pious phrases. Prayer may be joyous praise, or a humble plea for forgiveness. Prayer may be the childlike plea for the impossible, or the mature entreaty for moral growth and spiritual power. A petition may be for daily bread, or it may embody a wholehearted yearning to find God and to do his will. It may be a wholly selfish request or a true and magnificent gesture toward the realization of unselfish brotherhood. Prayer may be an angry cry for vengeance or a merciful intercession for one's enemies. It may be the expression of a hope of changing God or the powerful technique of changing oneself. It may be the cringing plea of a lost sinner before a supposedly stern judge, or the joyful expression of a liberated son of the living and merciful Heavenly Father. Modern man is perplexed by the thought of talking things over with God in a purely personal way. Many have abandoned regular praying. They only pray when under unusual pressure in emergencies. Man should be unafraid to talk to God, but only a spiritual child would undertake to persuade or presume to change God. That's the practice of magic, or the attempted practice of magic. That's where I think the energy comes from, Betty. You do use it up. And you got to refill the gas tank somewhere. I think that spiritual energy comes from prayer and from worship and meditation. I think psychic energy, mind energy losses are depleted through play, relaxation, refreshment, diversion. Jesus saying, let's take a day off. He went to, who was it, Andrew, and says, tell him I'm very tired and that I'd like to take a day off, and in resting, let's not talk about all this, all our problems, we should have some fun. This was psychological. Not necessarily spiritual. These men had raw nerve endings. They weren't out of spiritual gas.
Dorothy and I, discussing this, also felt that doing good, didn't we, in a sense, was a type of spiritual journey.
Sure. I think that we're equipped with three kinds of energy. If we work physically, we need calories and sleep. If we're working on a loading dock, I would say we need about 4,500 calories and 10 hours of sleep. I'd like to see what any of you would look like if you ate 4,500 calories a day for a year. The effects would be startling. We don't require that much physical energy because we're not burning it. We do require the restoration of mental energy, nervous energy, and I think that's play, relaxation, humor, having fun, dabbling at things. And then I think spiritually, this is the technique of recharging. We need to recharge in many ways. And then we need to discharge. This is living richly, to take in much and give out much. In my own philosophy of life, I want to live as richly as I can. And to me, to live richly is to receive from this life simply everything I have capacity to receive, and to give to this life everything that's within my power to give. And I couldn't honestly wish for the one without also being willing to pay the other. And the more that goes both ways, the richer the life. This is richness of living. This is life in technicolor, in a widescreen instead of black and white.
Well, this would appeal very much to me, but I don't quite know how to attain it. I have fears, inhibitions, things that hold me back from sipping.
Oh, well, we asked the questions in part 1, 2, and 3. We get the answers in part 4. I think I can find what I'm looking for. I think I want to go to the island of Crete and listen to Jesus talk to a young man. He either was afraid or run away.
The young man who was afraid.
He's going down to the mountain,
isn't he? I don't know. I think it's on Crete.
He met him up in the mountain.
Yeah.
Asked him how to find his way.
Jesus had a long talk with a young man who was fearful and downcast. Failing to derive comfort from association with these fellows, this youth had sought the solitude of the hills. He'd grown up with a feeling of helplessness and inferiority. These natural tendencies have been augmented by numerous difficult circumstances which the lad had encountered as he grew up, notably the loss of his father when he was 12 years of age. As they met, Jesus said, "Greetings, my friend. Why so downcast on such a beautiful day? If something has happened to distress you, perhaps I can in some manner assist you. At any rate, it affords me real pleasure to proffer my services." Oh, what a salesman. The young man was disinclined to talk, and so Jesus made a second approach to his soul, saying, "I understand. You come up in these hills to get away from folks, so, of course, you do not want to talk with me. But I would like to know whether you are familiar with these hills. Do you know the direction of the trails? And perchance could you inform me as the best route to Phoenix?" Now this youth was very familiar with these mountains, and he really became much interested in telling Jesus the way to Phoenix, so much so that he marked out all the trails on the ground and fully explained every detail. But he was startled and made curious when Jesus, after saying goodbye and making as if he were taking leave, suddenly turned to him, saying, "I well know you wish to be alone with your disconsolation, but it would be neither kind nor fair for me to receive such generous help from you as to how best to find my way to Phoenix and then unthinkingly to go away from you without making the least effort to answer your appealing request for help and guidance regarding the best route to the goal of destiny which you seek in your heart while you tarry here on the mountainside." You know, he'd do anything to help a person, wouldn't he? He'd make himself out to be dumb and humble. If he could only create that opportunity to accept help, which in turn would give him the chance to give help. Again, I say, what a salesman. "As you so well know the trails to Phoenix, having traversed them many times, so do I well know the way to the city of your disappointed hopes and thwarted ambitions. And since you've asked me for help, I will not disappoint you." The youth was almost overcome, but he managed to stammer out, But I didn't ask you for anything." And Jesus, laying a gentle hand on his shoulder, said, "No, son, not with words, but with longing looks did you appeal to my heart. My boy, to one who loves his fellows, there is an eloquent appeal for help in your countenance of discouragement and despair. Sit down with me while I tell you of the service trails and the happiness highways which lead from the sorrows of self to the joys of loving activities in the brotherhood of man and in the service of the God of heaven." But this time the young man much desired to talk with Jesus, and he knelt at his feet imploring Jesus to help him, to show him the way of escape from his world of personal sorrow and defeat. Said Jesus, "My friend, arise. Stand up like a man. You may be surrounded with small enemies and may be retarded by many obstacles, but the big things and the real things of this world and the universe are on your side. The sun rises every morning to salute you, just as it does the most powerful and prosperous man on earth. Look, you have a strong body and powerful muscles. Your physical equipment is better than the average. Of course, it is just about useless while you sit out here on the mountainside and grieve over your misfortunes, real and fancy. But you could do great things with your body if you would hasten off to where great things are waiting to be done. You are trying to run away from your unhappy self, but it cannot be done. You and your problems of living are real. You cannot escape them as long as you live. But look again. Your mind is clear and capable. Your strong body has an intelligent mind to direct it. Set your mind at work to solve its problems. Teach your intellect to work for you. Refuse longer to be dominated by fear like an unthinking animal. Your mind should be your courageous ally in the solution of your life problems, rather than your being, as you have been, its abject fear slave and the bondservant of depression and defeat. But most valuable of all, your potential of real achievement is the spirit which lives within you and which will stimulate and inspire your mind to control itself and activate the body if you will release it from the fetters of fear and thus enable your spiritual nature to begin your deliverance from the evils of inaction by the power presence of living faith. And then forthwith will this faith vanquish fear of men by the compelling presence of that new and all-dominating love of your fellows, which will so soon fill your soul to overflowing because of the consciousness which has been born in your heart that you are a child of God. This day, my son, you are to be reborn, reestablished as a man of faith, courage, and devoted service to man for God's sake. And when you become so readjusted to life within yourself, you become likewise readjusted to the universe. You have been born again, born of the Spirit, and henceforth will your whole life become one of victorious accomplishment. Trouble will invigorate you. Disappointment will spur you on. Difficulties will challenge you, and obstacles will stimulate you. Arise, young man. Say farewell to the life of cringing fear and fleeing cowardice. Hasten back to duty and live your life in the flesh as a son of God, a mortal dedicated to the ennobling service of man on earth and destined to the superb and eternal service of God in eternity.
That is our male attribute.
Yeah, he launched him on the paradise ascent. Let's see what the Greek had to say about this. Oh, I gotta find this. I have trouble with Roald Amundsen because I never can tell what part of the paper it's in. The quote I'm looking for is where Rodin says, "How can I release the forces of infinity which slumber within me?"
Oh, yes, I think that.
Yes. Let's see if we can get it in his words, though. Yes. The effort toward maturity.
That's a page.
1777. Second year of the Revolutionary War. The effort toward maturity necessitates work, and work requires energy. Whence the power to accomplish all this? The physical things can be taken for granted, but the Master has well said, man cannot live by bread alone. Mrs. Steen's bread would come close to that, but. Granted the possession of a normal body and reasonably good health, we must next look for those lures which will act as a stimulus to call forth man's slumbering spiritual forces. Jesus has taught us that God lives in man. Then how can we induce man to release these soul-bound powers of divinity and infinity? How shall we induce men to let go of God that he may spring forth to the refreshment of our souls while in transit outward, and then to serve the purpose of enlightening, uplifting, and blessing countless other souls? How best can I awaken these latent powers for good which lie dormant in your souls? One thing I'm sure of, emotional excitement is not the ideal spiritual stimulus. Excitement does not augment energy. It rather exhausts the powers of both mind and body. Whence then comes the energy to do these great things? Look to your master. Even now he's out in the hills taking in power, while we are here giving out energy. The secret of all this problem is wrapped up in spiritual communion in worship. From the human standpoint, it is a question of combined meditation and relaxation. Meditation makes the contact of mind with spirit. Relaxation determines the capacity for spiritual receptivity. And this interchange of strength for weakness, courage for fear, the will of God for the mind of self, constitutes worship. At least that is the way the philosopher views it. When these experiences are frequently repeated, they crystallize into habits, strength-giving and worshipful habits. And such habits eventually formulate themselves into a spiritual character. And such a character is finally recognized by one's fellows as a mature personality. These practices are difficult and time-consuming at first, but when they become habitual, they are at once restful and time-saving. The more complex society becomes, and the more the lures of civilization multiply, the more urgent will become the necessity for God-knowing individuals to form such protective habitual practices designed to conserve and augment the spiritual energies. Those two statements to me have always been complementary. Jesus, such personal advice to the boy, and then Rodin's philosophizing about exactly the same thing. And the answer, Betty, to your question is, if you want to do great things, you have to go to where great things are waiting to be done.
Now we're going to have a little discussion of free will.
I wonder where Julia is. Rescue myself.
Hi. Oh, I'm not too late.
He's
your right now exam.
Dorothy, yes, she has had to go to the pharmacy. Yes, yes. And he,
excuse me.
For being late, you're going to have to take an extra exam.
I'm already in the
dark
house, so you drive me. I need some company.
This is going to take time. There's only 25 questions.
Mm-hmm.
No fair peeking now.
I was going to say, but you don't know what they are.
I can't see them. I can't read it right.
Julia, if you turn in a typewritten examination, I'll understand.
With references.
Yeah.
Well, we'll have to stop talking about Betty now and get on to the book.
Right. Oh, I suspected as much. Sometimes feel I'm holding up progress here, but sort of tell me in a subtle way if I am.
What's
case
your pleasure
study
this afternoon?
Case study. Human paradoxes.
That's in the gesture and the soul, the part she's talking about.
Yes. I know what I want to teach you, but I'm much more interested in what you want to learn.
Oh, that's nice. Way to put it.
Well, that's interesting. It's adventurous. This discussion of human paradoxes runs all the way through this book. It might be likened to the problem of tightrope walking between spiritism and secularism, between courage, to have courage without pride. To be totally without pride involves the dismal picture of a deflated ego. And a deflated ego could best be described by likening it to a car with four flat tires. This car is very nearly useless. The problem is air pressure. How do we get enough air pressure in these tires so that the car is mobile? and runs well. This means we pump them up with pride. But there's always a danger that we pump too long and we blow the tires out in terms of self-love. It takes a little pride to make a person stand up. It took some pride for Van to take on Caligastia, Dalagastia, and then later on Lucifer as well. It took real courage there, and there's a component of pride in that courage. To be totally without pride would add up to being totally useless as a potential finality. A son is not a subservient slave. A son can take pride in membership in that family. A finaliter is not a puppet of God. A finaliter is a junior partner in relation to a senior partner. And there is a dignity involved in a partnership relation, no matter how small one of the partners is and how large the other partner may be. When you invest an animal with a complex personality, which really can choose, which really does have free will, when you back this up with a part of absolute divinity, absolute in terms of quality, though less than absolute in terms of quantity, undiluted, undiminished divinity. This individual has got so much equipment that he could look himself over and say, gee, aren't I wonderful? This is very much like one of the stewards, or better still, let's call them vice presidents. This big tycoon went on a journey, and he gave each of his vice presidents several million bucks and says, I've had it, boys, let's multiply the wealth. Suppose that that vice president had looked at these millions of dollars, not as a trustee, but as an owner, and taken great pride in the possession of these funds which had merely been entrusted to him. How can we have confidence in ourselves and at the same time realize that this wealth of personality and spirit nature is not ours by virtue of the fact that we've earned it? It's given to us. It's for free. If we can realize that this has been entrusted to us, then we can have confidence without too much pride. Great humility can be associated with great courage. And this is about the right air pressure for the tires on the automobile. It says somewhere, I think, in the technical advisors, of all places to find it, where they're talking about lawyers. What they're saying is that here it is. Got it on my second pass. The universal economy is based on intake and output. Throughout the eternal career, you will never encounter monotony of inaction or stagnation of personality. Progress is made possible by inherent motion. Achievement grows out of the divine capacity for action, and achievement is the child of imaginative adventure. But inherent in this capacity for achievement is the responsibility of ethics, the necessity for recognizing that the world and the universe are filled with a multitude of differing types of beings. All of this magnificent creation, including yourself, was not made just for you. This is not an egocentric universe. The gods have decreed, it is more blessed to give than to receive. And Jesus put it, it makes you happier to give than to receive. And said your master, son, he would be greatest among you, let him be server of all. I think this, if we would study Jesus' admonition to the Roman senator concerning wealth, we would get a peculiar kind of ethical yardstick wherewith to measure our own endowments. Jesus' admonition to the Roman is not capitalistic, socialistic, communistic, utopian, or anything else. It's one of the most original pronouncements on economics I've ever read in my life. Do you recall it? It has to do with degrees of ownership. And it's an amazing statement. And I think it helps. Jesus breaks wealth down into 10 kinds: inherited, discovered, trade, unfair, interest, genius, accidental, stolen, trusts, and earned. 1462. And in this section, he goes on to point out the degrees of ownership which attach to these different kinds of wealth, pointing out a principle. Number one, if it's unfair, get rid of it, make restitution. This leaves you with fair wealth, honorable wealth. And then he points out that your right to have a say in what is done with this is in direct proportion to the effort which you expended in the acquisition. The more you have personally done about this, the more you have to say about this. The less you've done, the more your ownership impinges on trusteeship. This,
Fair. Mm-hmm. It's all very fair.
Sure. This thing is proportional. Peter never told the Alpheus twins up on the Sea of Galilee near the end of his Marantia career on earth. He never told the Alpheus twins, now, boys, go out and preach to the multitudes. He sent them back to the fishnets. But to Peter he said, Peter, be a good shepherd, feed my sheep. Jesus had made an investment in Simon Peter, and he wanted that investment to pay out. Somewhere in the papers it makes the statement, what is loyalty? It is nothing but a feeling of fairness. How could you take so much and give nothing? These gifts which we've received from God, we didn't earn. It was a free will gift from God. We can be proud that He thought enough of us to make us these gifts. But the receipt of these gifts should create in us a feeling, first of affection for Him in return, and second of obligation. The greater the gift to the person, be it the thought adjuster from Divinington or just plain downright natural human aptitudes, the greater the gift, the greater the obligation to that person. The steward that got, the vice president that got $5 million was held accountable for what he could earn on $5 million. The VP that got $2 million was only accountable for what he could earn with too many. Somehow that means more to me when I talk about vice presidents and millions and stewards and talent. I look at it this way. If a human being has something, then he owes something. He owes something to the world in which he lives. This feeling of morality, you can get this right down on a human level. Consider the inheritance of an American. It's a very rich inheritance. We have reaped where we have not sown. We live in an imperfect society, yet one, which demands that children be educated. If my parents had not believed in education, society would have guaranteed me a minimum literacy. They would have guaranteed me enough so that if I was really hungry, I, on my own initiative, could have gone and fought for more. We live in a society which theorizes, at least, equality of justice. That's good. Even though we don't have it here, but at least we're striving for this. We live in a society which says we shall have the right to freedom of speech and freedom of worship. None of these things did we personally earn. All of these things represent an unearned inheritance. And again I say, how could we take so much and give nothing? Looking back, who made this possible? Well, a few big guys, but an awful lot of cooperating little people like us. It took a lot of support from small people for big people to make these advances. And again, let's pay out the investment. I have a feeling of moral responsibility to the society and to the imperfect civilization of which I'm a member. Again, how could we take so much and give nothing? How can you balance pride and courage? How can you balance altruism and egoism? You need a balance. Again, if you're completely non-egoistic, you've got four flat tires. You're of no use to anyone. And if you've got a great big overdeveloped ego, your tires are going to blow, and you're not much use to anyone either. How can you walk between, well, going back to Jesus, in that wonderful section on the acme of religious living in part 3, they use such words as this. His faith was childlike, but not childish. There's a world of difference. He depended on God, but never presumed on God. In other words, he did the things which he should do, and let trust that God would do the things which God should do and which he couldn't do. He had courage, but he was never audacious. He was warm-hearted, but not sentimental. He was stable, but not prosaic. How can we arrive at a balanced life? This is the only resolution, I think, of the human paradox. And again, they admire Jesus in these papers, not because, so much because he was one thing or another thing, but because of the exquisite symmetry of the balance of his character. He was generous, but not foolish. He was frugal, but not miserly. He was cautious, but never cowardly. This is something we each have to work out. I'm very proud that I can call myself a son of God, a human son of God. I'm very proud of the future which spreads out before me. But I also feel very humble because I didn't earn a damn bit of it. I can take credit only for how I use these talents. If I have any brains, I can't take credit for the brains. I was born with them. The genes were good to me. Neither can I be critical of someone who, well, as one superintendent put it, he says, "You mean my foreman here was out for a short beer when the Almighty passed out intelligence?" I said, "Check." That's right. He isn't to blame. The Alpheus twins did the best they could. This to me is the resolution of the human paradox. Can you receive? Gladly. And having received gladly, can you give generously? There's a cycle here. The more you get, the more you give. The more you have, the more is expected of you. Of the teacher, more is expected than of the pupil. And of the master, more than the servant. Can you keep the darn thing in proportion? I think the best technique is humor. Humor. And humor is over here. Page 549. Paragraph 3. When we are tempted to magnify our self-importance, if we stop to contemplate the infinity of the greatness and grandeur of our makers, our own self-importance glorification becomes sublimely ridiculous, even verging on the humorous. One of the functions of humor is to help all of us take ourselves less seriously. Humor is the divine antidote for exaltation of ego. I think one of the most rueful sessions of laughter I ever had in my life was in connection with a trip out to California. I had seen this group, and I had a very rugged weekend following out on San Pablo Bay with a couple of crazy marine buddies of mine who run a newspaper down there. And this was a very, very lost weekend. And coming back on the Super Chief, I barely made the train. I tumbled into bed because I'd done everything except sleep. The next morning I get up and I looked in the mirror, and the events of the weekend were writ in bold hand on my face. My eyes looked like a couple of bloody oysters floating in a bowl of skim milk. And the whiskers looked singularly unattractive. And I had a generally washed out expression, you know. It kind of like, I looked like a fellow that should go to school for many years to work up to the level of an Alpheus twin. And I got to laughing. And I thought, Willie, here you are trying to be St. Polycarp for the Blue Book movement. And if this is what our unseen friends has got to work with, God only knows they are real hard up now. They're hard up. I never felt so humorously humble in my whole blasted life. I have never forgotten that incident. And I had a feeling of tremendous compassion for these people that I can't see, which I'm sure produced this book. Jeez, they're hard up. They're desperate. They're out recruiting like we did during the war, you know. Is the body warm? Can he speak? Hire him, you know. And I think this, I can tell you this much about psychometric testing. This is not always true, but quite often, a person who is a real religious fanatic has an extremely high score in the religious motivation, and he just plain flunks our crude test of humor. He takes humor from the social intelligence test. You know, Moss, it isn't a very good test, but Lord, it's the only one in existence. You see, he takes God seriously, and that's wonderful. But then he takes himself seriously. And that's horrible. And I can just see him. Let's turn the clock back 500 years. Let's see, that would make this 1459. That does it. I can just see me standing up, you know, and the faggots are piled around my shins, and this guy with this thin-lipped smile is saying, "Sadler, for the good of your soul," because he likes the tinder, you know. And I don't want to be a martyr. I'm willing to be, but they're going to have to catch me first. These things to me are how to resolve this human paradox. Example. You try this sometime. Go out when the sky is pretty clear at night. When you can see, well, I always think of that cartoon, that wonderful cartoon in old Life magazine. It's in an alley on the Lower East Side of New York, and this is long before they began to put in modern housing. And there are two little kids standing in the alley, and there's washing hung out everywhere. They're looking up at the night sky, and the little boy is holding the hand of the little girl, and he's saying to her, "Gee, sis, look at the stars, as thick as bedbugs." So go on out some night when the stars are as thick as bedbugs, and start thinking about how big these are. And there. All right.
And maybe this looks like the light would be better for
no,
the
I'm all right.
to be over this way.
No, I'm feeling no pain. Consider the light years of distance. Consider that every one of those little specks, with the exception of the planets, is a star, and most of them are much bigger than our sun. Consider the vast distances that you're looking at. Consider how many planets there are, with how many people on them, each one of them with egos, each one of them with paradoxes to resolve, each one of them with a thought adjuster, personality, and the spirit of truth, and all the equipment that glitters so. Consider how little of the universe you're looking at. Consider how much more of the universe there is that you can't see. Just like this, it goes on and on and on. Consider that it's 500,000 light years from here into Uversa, which means it must be another 500,000 from Uversa in to the outer margins of Favona. Consider all that you can consider. Double it, cube it, take it to the fourth power. And then stop and think that all this tremendous picture which you're trying to build up in your mind is nothing but the least pinpoint of a revelation of an infinite God. And as you contemplate this, you'll start shrinking. You can't take this very long. Get inside quick before you disappear. You keep getting smaller and smaller and smaller and less significant. You follow me? Get in under the roof where you can feel normal sized again. Because I think you could completely vanish if you kept the process up long enough. This is good for the ego too. Here you are strutting around on a ball of mud, a little midge, squeaking in a tiny voice, "I am important, I am important, I am important, I am important." This is a quote from Flatland. It's a wonderful book, you ought to read it. Remember we were talking about Flatland? Well, the sphere takes the triangle of venture and he finally bounces him out of the two-dimensional existence. And they explore a single-dimensional land, which is a straight line, and they talk to the dots on the line. And then they finally explore a point, a zero-dimensional thing. This little point, they go very near, and this little squeaky voice, this point is saying, "I am alone, I'm alone, I'm important, I'm infinity, there's nothing beside me. And the story closes, I recall, the triangle talks to the sphere and suggests there may be a fourth dimension. And of course, the sphere gets very angry and insists that he is at the apex of creation. I don't know, it's written by a mathematician. It's a clever darn book. It's called Flatland. I've owned four copies of it and it's never returned. I'm currently out. But you ever stop and think, if you buy books all the time, and if no one stole them, you wouldn't have room for anything but books pretty soon. I'm grateful for all the people that steal my books.
What was the one by Mark Twain about paradise?
Report from Paradise. Oh, you folks ought to read that. It's Twain's 1907 or 8 analysis of the conventional ideas of heaven.
That isn't Captain Stormfield.
Yes, it is.
Captain Stormfield visits heaven, I think.
Captain Stormfield's Voyage to Heaven is one of the two stories that are published under the title Report from Paradise.
I didn't know the other one.
Stormfield's Voyage to Heaven was a collector's item until this came out. Well, I had one too. Yes. I had a first edition. I think there were only two editions of it. The human paradox, I think, is a matter of being sane. And sanity is defined in here as an orderly arrangement of mental systems. In other words, if you've got the adjuster operating as a controlling nucleus in your life vehicle, you're going to be fairly sane because you've got a stable atom there. You can swing your ego around the adjuster as an orbital electron, but you cannot swing the adjuster around your ego as a human nucleus. The masses are too disproportionate. If you try... Question?
Pardon me, you have said that we are all a little insane, and
I definitely.
Think we all agree. Does this book also agree that we are all a little insane?
No, that's my own idea.
So
even as Paul, some things I teach by commandment and others by permission. You shall not muzzle the ox that treadeth out the grain. No, I think we're all a bit insane. We don't really think. I think Jesus was sane, completely sane. I don't think anybody else has achieved that level of sanity. In other words, Jesus saw clearly. Jesus saw where values were. He was utterly sane. Now, I think we achieve relative degrees of sanity, which means we're relatively unsane. Because if we're less than totally sane, we're partly unsane.
This ought to be appropriate. Schweitzer wrote a book, The Case of the Psychiatric Study of Jesus.
Mm.
It's excellent. He tries to prove him insane, and at the end he says, there could be no more sanity.
Yes.
It's real good.
Yes.
What's the Psychiatric Study of Jesus. I got it in the background. I'm not sure that fits. It's real good.
Real sanity means...
Albert Schweitzer.
Real sanity means, in part, less rationalization. Rationalization is nothing but lying to yourself or finding good reasons for doing bad things. You know, it's an internal snow job. It means less projection. That is to say, a more honest criticism of one's own faults and less of criticizing of those faults when discovered in other people.
How can one be honest with themselves totally?
They can't. It's an ideal. I'm describing an ideal here. I don't think any of us can attain it. But that doesn't mean we can't strive for it. It's a matter of a degree of improvement. Yes.
The fact of self-consciousness means a certain amount of objectivity possibility.
Plus subjectivity.
Oh, yes, we've got that all the time.
Yes.
But I mean, it is possible to be a little objective.
Of course, and we can strive to be a little more.
That is inherent in
yes.
self-consciousness.
Right. And in striving to be a little more, we may be too harsh, because we are pendulumatic in our extremes. And here again, I think, is where humor comes in. Just about the time you think you're real sane, and maybe you should have an ST in front of your name, take a look in the looking glass and have a good laugh and get your feet back on the earth again. You know what I mean? Very good. Psychiatric Study of Jesus by Albert Schweitzer. Humor, I think, is humor along with prayer and worship are the tools of sanity, or how to keep from being an utter ass. How about a coffee break?
Just think, if that thing goes over in 500 years from now, they will be sending each other cure packages. Do you think, Bill, in a couple hundred years, talking about first edition, someone will say, I have a first edition of your encyclopedia?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, on that time.
Sure. Definitely.
And mine gets through to me better because ink is...
In about 200 years, I imagine, they will be using Urantia books that have been owned by St. Kagan for cures.
For cures?
Yes.
Yeah, heaven forbid.
Is that taped?
Yeah, that's taped.
Bill, I got this letter from Kenny.
Well, but you have a lot to live up to.
You know Jenny Allen.
Yes.
And she said, of all the 523 original members or something, they're all going, drifting here and there, wherever. But I guess what they want is that no one will be alive when the book is really prominent, so that to make saints out of her.
Sure,
like
that's
that.
Right.
Yes, so they don't want any shrines or any saints for this book. They want it all just to be books.
That's right.
Well, it's probably going to happen that way.
I expect to be butt up on the maybe the second mansion world, and you'll be there, and some of these arrivals will come with a St. Kagan deal, and what do you say we go out and get fried that night?
Good.
I'll be sitting in a corner pondering free will yet.
Of course, you see, there's never any problem for me, Bill. If I wore my collar backwards, my Adam's apple would puncture it.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You got another picture I have is Betty arriving on Paradise talking to the masters of philosophy. Is it really free? and then they'll take her down into the cellar down there, see? And they'll show her the cable and say, no, we hooked onto you and we've been turning this windlass ever since. You didn't have a chance.
I knew it.
I think it's an awfully good statement. Just above the human paradox on page 1221.